Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Helene. We've spent many hours on this program examining the devastation the storm brought to Western North Carolina and hearing about the pace and expense of recovery efforts. One area of that destruction and recovery that we've only touched on is the damage done to Western North Carolina's community of artists. We know that the River District, the River Arts District in Asheville, was inundated. Over 300 artists working in studios and galleries across 26 warehouses were impacted, as roughly 80% of the buildings and their contents were washed away. 170 miles east of Asheville, the Potters, who have worked in Seagrove, met a similar fate. Some of those artists lost their studio space, their equipment, and their finished works of art. Once considered a safe creative space, Helene proved disasters can happen anywhere. But the recovery has proven something else. People come together in tough times to help each other through. And that is what happened to that community as artists shared studio spaces, collected generators and other supplies. And although recovery efforts are ongoing, adversity will not stop the Mint Museum's annual Potter's Market later this month, highlighting work from more than 50 acclaimed North Carolina potters. Pottery has a long history in our state, dating back thousands of years. At first, indigenous people made utilitarian pottery, but over time, the rich clay found in North Carolina led to more creative work as potters gravitated to places like Seagrove. It became a mecca for pottery artists and enthusiasts, eventually becoming known as the pottery capital of the nation. Today, a look at disaster and revival, the rich history of pottery here, even the impact of climate change on the medium itself. We're joined by Ben Owen III. He's the owner of Ben Owen Pottery in Seagrove. Julie Wiggins owns Julie Wiggins Pottery in Bakersville near Penland School of Craft. And Annie Carlano is senior curator of craft, design, and fashion at the Mint Museum of Charlotte, which also happens to be an underwriter, an underwriter of programming here at WFAE, although that has nothing to do with their appearance on this program this morning. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Thank it's radio, you got to talk. So let me begin with Ben and Julie, the two potters in our midst. We're going to talk about the art and craft of pottery and the importance of Western Carolina, North Carolina, and the importance that it plays in the creation of those artifacts in a moment. But first, let's talk about how you and others were affected by Hurricane Helene about a year ago. How bad, how widespread was the destruction in your area, Ben?
Well, the Seagrove community is much more east of Asheville, right, and the mountains. I mean, we had more rain and some wind, but nowhere near the devastation, the damage that was taking place in the mountains. You typically think of something like this happening in along the coastline or somewhere like that, or the Gulf Coast and that kind of thing, and slightly inwards. But for the mountains of North Carolina, that was, as Julie can elaborate more on that, it just it was amazing just to see something like that happen.
Julie?
Yeah, it was absolutely devastating. I'm from North Carolina. I grew up on the coast in Jacksonville, North Carolina. I've experienced many hurricanes in my time. I have never seen anything like this. I moved to Penland 4 years ago from Charlotte, and I was thinking I'd have this beautiful, tranquil, chill life. And boy, was I in for a rude awakening. I've never seen water at that velocity come down the mountain the way it did. Everywhere around me was a river, and we were completely cut off. It wasn't just the water, it was the trees. So in Mitchell County, we have the most amount of trees in the state. We lost 60% of our trees, and they're still coming down. So, you know, we didn't have power for 6 to 8 weeks. My home was the first distribution center in the area. My friends and family on the coast were sending box trucks up on day 3, and I was able to supply my holler families and my artist community with the basic supplies that we needed. And the beauty about being a potter is that we are all family, no matter where we are, and our family and across the state. And Seagrove with Ben and Fred Johnston, they drove up here with tools, with machinery to help get the trees off our houses. So I speak about being activated during that time, and our whole pottery community was activated and how they could come in and help us.
And you were talking just before we went on the air about how you're going to fire some of the pottery that you'll be showing at the Potter's Market at the Mint on Monday. And this is the first time since Hurricane Helene that you've been able to operate your kiln. Why?
Well, I had a lot of damage to the kiln. The kiln was in a river, basically. It was under 4 feet of water, and I'm now having a landslide happen behind the kiln. So I had some damage to the bricks and just what's going around the kiln itself that needed to be repaired. All my wood washed away. We have trees down, but the trees are not viable. We need dry wood. So I've been aggressively trying to find dry wood. And this is a huge, huge milestone for me to be able to fire this kiln before the Mint.
Ben, I know you use wood in your kiln, and I asked a question that Annie chastised me for asking just before the show started. And that question was, why do you guys use wood? Why don't you use gas or why, natural gas or electricity to fire your kilns? Why wood?
Well, it's a great question, and it really can be answered in many different ways. The early type of work that was made by early settlers in this area were all fired with wood just because it was the source of fuel for heating the pottery to take it to a temperature to melt and vitrify the clay, make the glaze, or eventually become a glass and a waterproof surface on the vessels. But for wood firing today, especially fast forward to this time, 20th, 21st century, potters choose to fire with wood because it's almost like a chef deciding to, instead of putting salmon in the oven and baking it in a conventional way with maybe with some seasoning, you put it in a smoker and you enhance the flavor. You take and add things to it that only that method of firing can give the accents to the pieces and know that it's unique. And to try to recreate something like that in a gas or electric kiln is... Yeah. It's almost like adding artificial sugar to a cake recipe instead of the real thing.
It's interesting,
or in the form of a fruit.
Interesting you should mention that, because on, I think it was Friday night, I had dinner at a restaurant that says it doesn't have any gas or electric cooktops. Everything is done over open flame and wood. And let me tell you, you can taste the difference. It was wonderful. I read that the Arts District in Buncombe County, Asheville, that was wiped out by the floods, brought in $1 billion a year in annual sales prior to the storm. To me, that's astounding. How would that compare to the revenues that are produced by the potters in your area of the state, Julie and Ben? I'll start with you, Julie.
It's significant. I do show in the River Arts District at Clay Space, and to see where we were last year to now is unbelievable. The potters, you know, we're richly rooted in this area. People come from all over the country to buy ceramics, not just the Asheville area, but throughout the state. But it is a huge destination spot for people. It has been, you know, slowly watching all the businesses in the River Arts District rebuild. The Lower Street it's not going to be able to, you know, we're years away from the infrastructure for that to be in place. But for us, as far as revenue, I mean, you know, we've been hit so hard. We're just not seeing people come up the mountain to buy work. You know, there's really nowhere for people to stay, you know, hotels and small little places. Like I have a little Airbnb here. People are slowly starting to come back, and we have our own market coming up here after the Mint, the Spruce Pine Potters Market. We didn't have that last year. That is a huge moneymaker for a lot of potters here. So we lost significant income last year. Well,
Ben?
We still are.
Ben?
Yeah, it's really the economic impact. We rely on this so much in the SEGRO community. There are over 100 potters. A lot of them are husband and wife or couples, and they represent not only a foundation of early potters of this area and how they were able to have a life making pots. My grandfather was one of the first generations to really be, instead of a farmer potter, they were able to work and be a full-time potter and support their family just because of Pinehurst being nearby. Charlotte, we call it the Four Corners, kind of Charlotte, Pinehurst, Piedmont Triad, and Research Triangle Park, a day trip for people to come out. But from the same standpoint, just looking at the economic impact, I mean, the arts have grown so much over the last many decades in the mountains of North Carolina, and it's been a destination for people to go. And for people to not to be able to go last fall during the fall, seeing the leaves and just being able to enjoy the cooler weather and be able to visit artisans like Julie and many others in the mountains, it just we had to reach out. And as an artist, a fellow artist in this area, I just couldn't sit back and watch what was happening and not do something to try to help. And as Julia mentioned earlier, many different people came to the rescue to help the mountains, but to help them to get back to a point where they could continue working in clay and then be able to support their families.
I know that and you just talked about it, the fact that this is how you make a living through your art. And to me, were I an artist, which I am not, and I can prove that, if to me, I would be hard pressed to sell anything that I had made because I'd want to keep it for myself after all that hard work and creativity. I can't imagine, though, what it must be like to lose finished work to a storm where it's washed away or destroyed in some way. And Annie, I get the impression, Julie, rather, I get the impression that you may have experienced that, and certainly no other potters who did. How can you put the feeling of what that feels like into words?
You know, I get a bit emotional talking about it still. I mean, in the middle of the storm, I was running all of my inventory in my home because my building was underwater that stored all of my materials. And I just fired my wood kiln, and that's where my booth display is. And I was just, you know, in a panic of like, do I let it go? Do I lose everything that I worked so hard for? Or do I try to salvage what I can? For me, I had less damage than many people, many of my artist friends, but it still was significant for me. And, you know, just, I don't know. What's been the biggest struggle, I think, is those of us getting back to work. We have a bit of a survivor's guilt. You know, many of us still have a home, but there's still trauma around the survival stages of those months, that has made it hard for us to get back to work, hard for me to get my studio and think about making these objects of joy, which I love doing and I love that people connect to it. But when my community was still needing generators and needing basic supplies, there was no way I could get in my studio and work when I finally did get power back. I'm so committed to my community and helping us rebuild, constantly working with our events committee with Downtown Spruce Pine to raise money and create opportunity for artists here to make money. I will say the beauty of the story is how we all came together.
Well, we have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But then we're going to move on into the importance of pottery to North Carolina and how it became important, an important area in the country for that art form, in advance of the Potter's Market at the Mint on Saturday, September 27th. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the importance of pottery making in North Carolina to North Carolina and to the fact that we are the kind of recognized, at least the mountains around Seagrove or the area around Seagrove, is recognized as kind of the pottery capital of the country. Ben Owen III is here. He's a fifth generation potter, I believe.
Sixth generation
potter, and owner of Ben Owen Pottery in Seagrove. Julie Wiggins is the owner of Julie Wiggins Pottery in Bakersfield. Both of them will be part of the collective of artists exhibiting and selling their wares at the pottery market at the Mint Museum on Saturday, September 27th. And Andy Carlano is senior curator at the Craft Design and Fashion at the Mint Museum. Annie, I know that museums plan things way in advance. Julie was talking a minute ago about not being able to produce their local show last year. But the Mint has been producing this show for a long, long time. Was this maybe going to have to be on the back burner? When did you know you could actually go through with this year?
I think we knew the day after Potter's Market 2024 that the museum and the community was going to find a way to bring potters together again. This is the 19th Potter's Market at the Mint Museum. And we were confident, again, you heard Ben and Julie talk about clay community in this state. It's unlike anything other than the clay community in northern New Mexico, which is similar. And it's not so different from the food community, I have to say, meaning that everyone comes together, not just the potters, but those of us who support the potters, either through research or publication or Potter's Market or the collectors, the gallerists from throughout the country. You know, where there's a will, there's a way. And we made it happen. And I have to say, the reason we could afford to make this happen again was through the generosity of Principal Foundation. And I have to underscore their generosity. They are funding every potter in this market. They're paying the booth fees. It costs the artists nothing. And that's a tremendous gift. They're sponsoring in other ways, but when they let us know through their charitable giving that they wanted to make it as easy for the potters to participate, given the devastation, losing your home and just losing the ability to move about. What Julie and Ben have not yet talked about is the fact that some of us who wanted to help, you know, bringing up water and other ways of assisting up in the mountains, you couldn't get there. Roads were blocked. So it is a miracle that Ben and Fred Johnston and others from Seagrove even got there. But that's the dedication of our ceramics community. And I'm getting emotional like Julie. It's certainly one of the, I have a very multifaceted job at the Mint. I oversee three vastly different but connected areas. This is one of the most joyful responsibilities of my position here.
You've mentioned that, I've mentioned that this is kind of the pottery capital of the country. Annie, you mentioned that this is, I guess, the first, New Mexico and us would be the leaders in the pottery craft industry in the country. And if you've lived in North Carolina, Ben, for any amount of time, you know about Seagrove Potters, and you know that there's this critical mass of artists working there. I'm just wondering why. And your family goes back almost to the very beginnings of this. How did Seagrove and that area of North Carolina become this epicenter of the creation of pottery?
Well, the, The amazing thing about North Carolina is it has an abundance of natural resources in the form of clay. The materials are spread anywhere from the coast, believe it or not, even under sand. If you dig deep enough, you could find the clays and the Piedmont area where Seagrove is. There's just great materials that you can find, just a wide variety from red, yellow, blue, white clays. Catawba Valley up around Hickory, Lincolnton area, just a rich environment for clay materials, been in different deposits. And in the mountains, you think, well, it'd be mostly rock or that kind of thing, but there are pockets of clay up in the mountains that have made just a wonderful resource for potters. But back to your original question, the foundation of clay and in the southeast, really established in North Carolina through Seagrove and Pentland area, Catawba Valley, I mentioned, Asheville, Buncombe County areas, that families were able to come and move here and they were able to support their families in the early years. And they were mainly farmers, but they made pots on the side, either in the winter months or the off season from dealing with crops and other things like that to support their families. But the 19th, late 19th, early 20th century, aside from making storage jars and containers and things like that, the 20th century brought on a whole new look or a pivotal point in what was going on in the world of clay and more specifically pottery. The Industrial Revolution had taken clay to a different level, or glass, metal containers, and things like that that were being produced that the local mom and pop potters that made work in the small pockets or villages, they couldn't compete with industrial methods. So they had to retool and change the type of work they were making. They still continued making functional pots for people to use, but they elaborated into more decorative, more outside influences from Southeast Asia, Middle Eastern, Mesopotamian, early European ancestry. But in short, it just really opened a whole new palette of color, design, more creativity, learning more about form and design, looking at other cultures. And that was how pottery was able to flourish and survive in this community because of outside influences. The Busbys, Jacques Julian Busby, that came to Seagrove area, they discovered the potters kind of at an idle state. And they thought, wow, we've got to do something. They have such excellent craftsmanship in these vessels they're making. How can we be instrumental in helping? Very much like the Mint Museum. The Mint Museum has been such a great foundation of educating people, whether it's the pre-Columbian exhibition there to more modern and contemporary types of ceramic work by artisans from all over the world that have been able to showcase here at the Mint in North Carolina, that not only are we educating people about the history and the foundation of clay, but we're also telling them about Pentland School of Crafts, that you can go and have your hands put some clay under your fingernails and go take a class there, or John C. Campbell and other schools that are around the state, that the clay is a big part of our foundation, and we're very grateful for that.
Julie, you've been doing this for several decades now, I take it, because I know you majored in this at college, and you had your own studio here and your own shop here in Charlotte. And a couple of years ago, you moved to that area of the state. It was that simply to be in the collective, so to speak, of potters, because there's a synergy and an energy there when you're around others of like minds?
Absolutely. So that seed was planted for me back in the 1900s. In 1997, I came and took a class with Dan Finnegan, and I was 19. I was a young, budding artist, and I'd never been to a place like Pentland. And I just was so drawn to the vibration and the energy and the connection to the Appalachian crafts. So you can feel it here, like it is rich in that creative spirit. And I wanted to be part of more of that community. I mean, my neighborhood, my walks with my dog now are more like, hey, what'd you make today in your studio? Or I'll call up a friend, hey, I need a thermocouple. I need, instead of like I need a cup of sugar, it's a glaze material and a potter's around the corner where I can go get that thing. Especially now that our clay distributor flooded. We're talking a little bit about scarcity. Our materials are shifting all the time. So living here in a place where I can have access to other people is great. And I knew I always wanted to live at Penland.
Annie, we're going to talk a little bit about the different styles that Julie and Ben are involved in terms of their own work. But from the 30,000 foot level that the Mint Museum might have, talk to me about the work that's being done in that area of our state now, and over the decades that makes it worthy of a museum's attention.
Oh, well, that would take an hour
We don't want that.
because the clay community is so rich. And what has happened, I think Ben very eloquently covered the history in Seagrove and a little bit the mountains. But let's talk about this century, because we're already 25 years into it. And for me, what's so exciting about what's going on in North Carolina today with ceramics is we have two things simultaneously going on and intermingling, and that's the tradition. Those Seagrove potters, the potters in the mountains, who are continuing. Not just wood-fired or salt glaze or ash production, but are taking those traditions to a contemporary level, either due to form or maybe glaze innovation. So you've got tradition-based and coming from ceramicists who've been here. At least for decades. But because we are the clay state, people are moving here, ceramicists, potters from all over the country and all over the world, and they are bringing their traditions. I think foremost of Japan, the impact of Japan, even on our friend Ben Owen here. And Asian ceramics. I'm looking at one of his beautiful large vessels, and I think of your mantra, Ben, keep it simple. So you have ceramicists here who are influenced by an Asian aesthetic, in part because of potters from Japan being here, and in part because of their own world travels. And you have people moving here from the Middle East. And I do want to say, as Ben pointed out, it's not just Seagrove and the mountains. We've got great talent everywhere. And I'm thinking of people, Greensboro, and just throughout the state. So it's the influx of people coming here because of the clay community. And so you have a variety of styles. There's no longer one style unless you want to talk about traditional, functional stoneware, for
And
example. And you have people.
Ben, your family came here to farm. This is a long time ago. They didn't come here to be potters or ceramicists. They came here to farm, and they found out that I guess the clay pottery was something they did because they needed containers. They needed the utilitarian container to put things in. But at what point did your family begin to look at these as objects of art and begin experimenting with the different forms, different shapes, different glazes, and seeing these things not just as jugs to put things in? When did that happen?
Well, the interesting thing was when I mentioned earlier about the Busbys that came in and other catalysts came into
This
the
is
area.
the Busbys that you're referring to were in the 1920s, is that correct?
Early 1900s, yeah,
Okay.
19-teens.
Okay.
They came and they had first found some pottery at a fair where Juliana was like helping judge at the fair, an event, and just happened to see this display with pottery for decorating and just for the I guess the blue ribbon or whatever for the fair kind of thing, and And they were more interested in the pottery, like, well, we love your display and what you've done with this, but where did these pots come from? So it led them on a journey and just trying to find a way to come down to a little community called Why Not. So it was, like, well, why is it called Why Not? And then the short story is everybody wanted to name their community something. Why not this? Why not that? They named it Why Not. So it's just right outside the town of Seagrove. So now it's just a road on a sign on the side of the road. But anyway, my point being is they had this journey coming to find the potters that were making these pieces, and they saw them as, well, we're just farming and we can't compete with this glass and metal containers and things like that that's now being produced, that we're just going to have to go and work in other trades. But for the potters that were willing to listen and change and adapt, they took it on as an adventure to teach them some things from Southeast Asia and other things I touched on, that more colorful glazes, more ornate in design, and thinking about the surface of the vessel, creating a different dimension than it just holding 1 gallon or hold a candle in it and that kind of thing. So, but how do you stylize something like that and it still be a sense of beauty? And that's how really from the 1920s, a little over 100 years ago, they began introducing these type of pieces and sending it to New York, to Greenwich Village. They had a tea room up there. They ran that for many years before they even really ran the pottery full time here in North Carolina. But they lured the people into North Carolina by taking the work to the audience in New York and other places. And they brought them back here, with Pinehurst being nearby, people starting to travel into the South, and they took the adventure to go visit a potter and visit a pottery here in the community. The Cole family, the Cravens, the Teagues, the Lux, McNeils, Crisco's, Allman families, all those families were making pots in the area aside from the Owen family. And so it became kind of a thing, an experience, but also take this work home. And then people go to the dinner table and ask, well, where'd you buy that vase that has the beautiful bouquet of flowers in it? Or why did they paint flowers on the side of that pot? Who did that?
And that is when she took the pottery to New York and had her tea room. That's one way she attracted attention to the pottery being created and the ceramics being created here in North Carolina. But people would ask at the tea shop, where'd you get that teacup? Because they'd never seen anything quite like that. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more here about Julie's background and more about the Potter's Market at the Mint coming up later this month when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about pottery in North Carolina, the importance of pottery, recovering from the Hurricane Helene about a year ago up in the mountains there, where it's much of it is made. It's the epicenter of pottery in the United States. Ben Owen III is with us, owner of Ben Owen Pottery in Seagrove. Julie Wiggins is here, owner of Julie Wiggins Pottery in Bakersfield. They're both exhibiting at the Potter's Market at the Mint on September 27th, and Andy Carlano is the senior curator for craft design and fashion at the Mint Museum. Your work, Ben, is described as incorporating a foundation in early American designs as well as influences from Asia, Europe, and Persia. And the results of your work can be found in museums all over this country and, in fact, in Japan. And I believe you are also the recipient of an award, I'm going to mispronounce this, the Xingzhenzhen Ceramic Institute in China. Help me with that. Is that how you say that, Ben?
I'm not sure. So,
Annie, do you know?
I do.
Xingzhen, you
okay,
said it
Julie?
Correctly, I think.
Julie?
I got my graduate degree from Xingzhen Ceramic Institute. So Ben and I are both very familiar with that area. But you did a great job, Mike. Did a great job.
Well, then, Julie, Ben comes from this long, long line of potters. You're relatively new to this, it seems to me, in the scheme of things when you compare it to Ben. You received a BFA in ceramics from East Carolina. How did you come to this art form? Because you're also a dancer. What was it about this that attracted you to it?
Well, I was honestly, I went off to East Carolina, not sure what I was going to get my degree in. And I was working with a now very good friend, fellow potter, Jen Mecca, at a coffee shop. And she was getting her degree in ceramics. And I said, oh, I didn't know that was such a thing. And I started going and watching her work. And I was hooked. It was love at first sight. I was something I was good at. And, you know, like you spoke to me being a dancer, for me, it's dancing with my hands. And it's just another form, another extension of movement. So it really resonated with me. And I have never looked back. I've been so curious about the material. I've been traveling the world studying ceramics. Like I mentioned, I went to Jing Dajian Ceramic Institute in 2005 and received my graduate degree. And I haven't just stopped there. This summer I was in Greece doing a ceramic residency, and in Italy. Like, I'm chasing those historical pots and I'm trying to give them a nod to history, but with my contemporary flair and version. I'm always looking at how I can, you know, use these old traditional forms with this like new age way. I hope that answered that.
Yeah, I misspoke a minute ago. I associated the fact that Ben is on display at a museum in Japan with your honorary degree from the Jinzhenzhen Ceramic Institute in China. How is that influence, that Eastern influence, reflected in your work, both in the shape of what you create and in the designs you put on it? Because some of those designs are incredibly delicate but complicated.
Yes. So working in porcelain, that was where I really came to love porcelain, because in that area in China, the Ming Dynasty, where the blue and whites was really well known. So I came to really appreciate the characteristic traits of porcelain, and when I came home, I wanted to have my own kind of blue and white approach. So instead of decorating on top of, like the traditional way is, I decorate into the clay. And I'm using imagery that surrounds me. I'm a big gardener, so florals in my own garden and around the world inspire me, traditional motifs. So I was just in Deruta, Italy, and I came home and did a segment of imagery all from those, you know, motifs that are 100 years dated back. But, you know, I love that it's like I'm bringing them back. It's like they're not done, you know. That's like, why can't we still use some of those? And it gives me an opportunity to talk to people about the history of ceramics and the importance it's played throughout history and time, how people would come together. So for me, it's an opportunity just to connect and educate with my customers.
One of the things that makes artwork different from mass production pieces of that you might buy at a department store is the fact it's one of a kind and it's handmade and it comes from the inspiration of the person who made it. And I'm just curious, Ben, you've been doing this a long time and your work, your family's work dates back many, many years. How you keep it fresh? Where do the new ideas come from? How do you prevent yourself from just churning out the same thing every time?
That's a great question. A lot of people have asked, well, will you continue making some of the old things and the foundation of your work and your family's work, or will you branch out and do new things? And through experiences back in the mid-1990s, after I was out of college, I actually went to school at East Carolina University as well. But I wanted to take an extra step and just being able to be immersed in other cultures. And one of the things that really stood out was through a fellowship I had in Japan, where I worked with potters firsthand in a village there and just had a whole summer to really work and make pots and understand the history, such a rich foundation and tradition there, even deeper than what we have here in America. But it was through that experience, I came home with so many new ideas and things I wanted to do. But I'll never forget my father saying, okay, son, just I know you have a lot of new ideas, but just go slow with it. Just try to introduce some of them slowly through what you do. And it was through the surface treatment. It was through either carving on the surface, or it was with the science of working with glazes, creating a different palette of colors and textures. And even more, it was how we were firing our wood kilns. as I touched on earlier, wood was a source of fuel for a lot of potters to finish work in this community. But when I went to Japan and through other experiences, I was able to understand that taking a longer approach to the firing, going and holding the kiln at a temperature over and above 2300 degrees Fahrenheit for anywhere from 48 to 60 hours, that you create a whole different palette of colors and effects that are on the surface of the clay vessels through the deposit of the ash, other effects that take place along the way, or the ash overlapping a pre-applied glaze on the surface, that you can tell the mark of a wood-fired pot. And I often reflect and compare when pots are made in a wood-fired kiln. It's almost like these pots are frozen in time, somewhat like a sunset. If the clouds are set in the horizon, the sun is setting, the time of year, the barometric pressure, all of these variables play at hand and what that kind of color scheme will be. Very much the same way our pots are being frozen with that moment of color and effect because of the experience they just had a performance in the wood kiln.
You just spoke about things that that are out of your control, barometric pressure and things like that, temperature and weather conditions. And when we think about climate change, we don't generally think about its impact on potters and pottery or ceramics. But in other parts of the world, it is having an impact already. In India, the summer months have traditionally been the best time for pottery, but now the temperatures have become unbearably hot. Parts of India have been experiencing these lethally high temperatures where potters are completely unable to work in those conditions. In other parts of India, the changing climate is drying up rivers, even as groundwater supplies are shrinking, reducing access to water for potters because it's being reserved to drink. While in Fiji, increased rainfall and longer cyclone seasons have reduced the window in which you can collect clay, and it's changed the nature, the quality of the clay that they use. Aside from Hurricane Helene and the damage that it did in the immediate aftermath, which can be partly tied to climate change, do either of you as artists have concerns about climate change and the impact it may have on your craft? Julie, you're nodding vigorously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The mines are closing that mine some of our major materials that we make our glazes with. I spoke about our clay distributor that flooded in Asheville and a lot of the materials we would get there. Some of those materials were the last that were in the mine and now they're just gone. I started to see the scarcity when I was doing my studies in China, and then really saw it again this summer in Greece. Where these places were firing wood kilns prolifically for centuries, I understand now why they aren't. And we're just starting to see that result here of having materials that we need. You know, my clay has gone up 50% since spring. So being able to find those materials that make the things that we need is becoming scarce and almost unaffordable. So we're having to reformulate glazes and other, you know, our clay bodies to be able to adapt to the changes.
You want to add to that, Ben, or did she pretty much cover it?
I think it's really true. I've had to change as far as my sourcing of clays, which is open opportunity for me, but it's also required more time to research it. But I'm finding clay deposits where I actually have to go and hire or rent equipment and dig the clay myself just because I want to know that I have a supply of clay for the future. And we are fortunate we have the
facility. Which is how it started. It's not that how it started for you. Were you not given the job by your grandfather of going out and finding the clay and removing the rocks and stones from it so it could be worked with in the shop?
I would help with the processing, but early on I didn't source it, but they knew where to go and find it in the area. But now I'm even reaching out to Catawba Valley area down near Charlotte, Kings Mountain area. I use a clay from there because of just some of the byproducts that are in those clays that help enhance our colors. So it's very much like a chef sourcing food to table. A lot of the ingredients that go into making a dish really wonderful in our world, making a clay be successful with a good backbone that it holds up, the structural integrity of the material is going to hold up. You spend all that time working and making the vessel, decorating it, firing it, and then it cracks. We can't sell cracked pots. So It's just you need to know that you have a foundation of materials to work with. But some of
Amazing.
our ingredients for glaze, making the colors in glass, have tripled or quadrupled. Some of the ingredients of like from copper, I heard it's going to change. It's going to go up 50% soon on the cost of it and other variables. So we try not to pass it on to our customers, but some things we've been forced to have to increase our prices just because of that. And we just trying to do the best we can to keep it manageable.
If you need clay, you can come to my backyard anytime you want to. Annie, I don't want to run out of time before we talk a little bit more about the Potter's Market, which is coming up at the Mint on Randolph Road on the 27th of September. Both Ben and Julie's work will be on display and for sale, along with about 50 other potters at that Potter's Market. It's also an opportunity to just look at the work, that very much like you would at the museum. How would you describe this 19-year running one-day event, Annie?
I would describe it as the largest and most important display of the breadth of work going on in North Carolina, the diversity of styles, the opportunity, unlike a gallery, the opportunity you have to meet the potters, to talk with them about the work that maybe you're buying or and get to know that artist. I'm sure Julie and Ben will tell you that they have made lifelong friends through the Mint's Potter's Market. And I would say most of all, of course, because the Mint being a museum and very education focused, it's an opportunity to really learn. You too, Mike, should come and understand what a wood-fired pot looks like versus a pot fired in a kiln, or understand how a particular maker has manipulated the clay to create sculpture. Because I want everyone to know that Potter's Market gives you the opportunity to buy a mug like this, although this is from Penland, I cannot lie, Penland 2023. But there you go.
Yeah.
At any rate, you can buy things that are useful and beautiful, quote William Morris, but you can also buy sculpture that's useful because it increases your well-being, and beautiful. And we're also going to have a beer garden. There will be live pottery demonstrations. So what Julie and Ben haven't talked about is how they make what they make, right? They tend to throw pots on a wheel, but there are potters who do not so much in this rendition, the 19th
Well, like
Potter's
Julie.
Market, but there is coiling. There are people who work with slabs. There you go. There's some coiling.
Yeah, for
And
those
then.
who for those who are listening on the radio, they can't see the visuals. I just want we're seeing each other, but our listeners can't see it.
Thank you.
Very, very quickly, because I'm running out of time. How do you select these 50 artists for this presentation?
Well, the Mint Museum hires national jurors. And this year, I have to say, they were extremely illustrious. Mindy Solomon from Mindy Solomon Gallery in Miami, Nancy Strickland Chavis, who is the director curator of the Museum of the Southeast American Indian at UNC Pembroke, and Kevin Snipes, who's a nationally known ceramicist based in Philadelphia. They were our judges. And they call from those who've, it's an invite, it's juried. And so we have a little more than 50 potters this year. And I have to tell you, 30 of them are from Western North Carolina. And then we have 10 who are new to Potter's Market for the first time. So those of you who have come to Potter's Market before and think you've seen everything and know everything, you will still see new work and new work by potters you love.
Potter's Market, by the way, is going to be at the Mint Museum on Randolph Road, not the one uptown, the one on Randolph, the original, an unduplicatable one, on Saturday, September 27th from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. Andy Carlano is the senior curator for craft design and fashion there. And two of our other guests will be exhibiting and selling their work, Ben Owen III from Ben Owen Pottery and Julie Wiggins, owner of Julie Wiggins Pottery. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.